The season two premiere of From is over, but guys, where are we? We are in the From podcast here on Post Show Recaps, covering season two of the Harold Perrineau starring thriller on MGM Plus, From. I'm Josh Wigler. I'm joined here by a guy who just barfed all over my shirt, Rich Filiberto, a.k.a. DM Philly.
Oh, I'm sorry about that barf, spark plug. You're right. Is that okay? It does no, smell kind of bad in here. That's my
it
fault.
It smells gross in this hot bus. Man, I'm not like rich in shirts. You know, I'm trapped in this hellscape town, and now one of my like four T-shirts, it's got your puke on it, dude. This sucks.
I know. It's very funny because this is exactly what I was thinking. It's like, little does this guy know how important that shirt is about to become in his life.
He needs to like find, they got to have washing machines, I would think. Like if they've got the electricity situation that they've had, he needs to find like a washing machine immediately. Clean that shirt now.
My great concern is, do you think Jade dismantled all the washing machines to build the tower, right? I mean, that's the actual problem. But we got electricity. We should have some wash happening, yeah.
We should wash it. Of course, we're going to put this episode of From through the proverbial washer and dry it off here with a recap. We've got a lot to discuss as From is officially back. And this is our first official episode recap that we're doing here on the From podcast. We already invited Harold Perrineau and Ian Bailey onto the podcast to tell you that you should be watching From. Hopefully that worked. Hopefully we have a lot of new people who are checking out the From at this point in time. Certainly seems like a bunch of patrons of Post Show Recaps are getting their From on. So we love to see that. After our little kickoff show there, Rich and I got together to give an overview of the show up through this point. I had such a fun time doing that podcast with you, Rich, but I'm even more excited now that we officially have an episode of From Strangers in a Strange Land to discuss here on the From podcast. And I thought a really eventful season two premiere. Do you want to talk about it real quick? Do you want to do a quick plot recap here, Rich?
I would love to. Let's jump into the diner. I was excited after the preview pod that we got our own like bus full of listeners appeared to pull up in front of said diner for From. So I'm psyched. Talk it through.
From season two, episode one, Strangers in a Strange Land. And no, it has nothing to do with tattoos. Following on the heels of the season one finale, a brand new group comes into town by bus with passengers including a dreamer named Elgin, a nurse practitioner who is also Christie's fiance, and a dude who looks like Jimmy from Yellowstone. It's all hands on deck to get the bus crowd acclimated, and when diplomacy doesn't work, Donna and Kenny are forced to resort to shooting tires and the air respectively. Maybe they should have led with infinite pancakes. Elsewhere in town, Jade gets Ethan's help on his continued quest to understand the enigmatic symbol he keeps seeing. Jim and bartender Tom get stuck underneath the rubble of the Matthews house when they try to dig out Tabitha, who's also underneath the house, negotiating a network of very scary corpse-filled tunnels alongside Victor. In other claustrophobia-inducing news, Boyd is still trapped inside of a wall, but some creepy old man chained to a wall helps him climb out. Climbing out! All he wants in return for his service is to die by Boyd's hand. Who the hell is this guy? Is it old man Desmond? The Count of Frummy Cristo? Let's start digging into the episode slowly, though. We don't want it to cave in on itself, Rich.
Strangers in a Strange Land, Josh. I still can't get over it. We don't want it to cave in on itself. We have to do it very slowly and carefully, one piece at a time, so it does not all collapse.
One piece at a time, which is exactly how we will break this episode down now that the plot is out of the way. Some quick reminders, of course. We've got our own From podcast feed. You want to make sure you're subscribed to it. PostShowRecaps.com/From is the short link. When you search by URL, plug in the RSS feed, you will find us. Ratings and reviews. Oh my God, I cannot even tell you how greatly appreciated they are. This is how we're going to convince all of the other Greyhound buses to roll up into our podcast and get trapped with us forever. So please, some ratings and reviews would be tremendously appreciated at postshowrecaps.com/from, our RSS link when you search by URL. We're also still in the Down the Hatch podcast feed, sharing space with the great Mrs. Davis on Peacock, which as we are recording this podcast, Rich, because we're a little bit ahead of the ball, that show has not dropped yet on Peacock. I cannot wait for you specifically to watch it, Rich.
I am so hyped, dude. Ooh, what a time boy, to be great. Alive. The Down the Hatch feed. You got Battlestar Galactica coming up. Mrs. Davis. We are kicking From. This is good stuff, Josh. This is very good stuff.
We've gone full DTH here on PSR, and it is quite the time to be alive. If you want to send feedback in about From or anything, you can email me, josh@postshowrecaps.com. I am available, so please send a note, josh@postshowrecaps.com. All right, Rich, we have gotten into what the plot of this episode is. We're going to break it down by storyline. Let's talk vibes first and foremost. You know, we're immediately following the heels of the season one finale of From. We're hopping right into it here in the show. What did you think? We have new characters, we've got new mysteries, new locations, and some barf.
I really loved it. I thought it was great. The introduction of the new characters, you know, we talked about it on the preview pod a little bit, but big like Tailies vibes. You can already pull a couple of like weirdos out of this ensemble that will be important, of like lady dancing in the rain, guy who looks like Jimmy and is trapped in the basement, you know, a healthcare professional who's probably somebody's fiance. Oh, right. There we go.
Yes, reunion. Definitely. Yep.
It was really fun. I dug it. I loved going back to a lot of the characters we established in season one is like these folks that showed up presumably, I don't know, 10 days ago are now like grizzled veterans of the From experience, right? The stop-ins with Jade. I really love the Victor and Tabitha stuff. I thought there was a lot of great stuff, like vibes, more mysterious, more questions, right? But I do like the way that it just reset. Okay, here's where everybody is. Here's all our moving parts. Let's get ready to track them as we go.
Yeah. Shouts to the newcomers. I think that pretty quickly there's a lot of energy coming from these people who are hopping off of the bus. We don't have character names, I think, for basically any of them other than Elgin. We know that's the character who's played by Nathan D. Simmons. He is the dreamer. We have yet another dreamer on the menu here, Rich. So Nathan D. Simmons is playing Elgin. Kaylin Ohm is the nurse practitioner who's clearly Christy's fiance. Angela Moore is the bus driver. I think her name was Bakta. I was trying to read the name tag. I think that that's what I got. AJ Simmons is our Jimmy adjacent. He seems to be like coming in with some like shaved head Sawyer energy. Rich, I feel like we get this guy in the same scene with Jade and it's going to be combustible. And then Deborah Grover is the name of the actress who is the rain dancer. Is she like our like old lady Locke who is going to have communion with the elemental nature of this place, Rich? She seemed to be able to pray the rain away.
She was able to cast Control Weather, which is like an eighth-level spell, so that's actually pretty impressive. I'm very excited to see this hothead, not Jimmy, interact with Jade. This guy came out like shot out of a cannon, and I'm really like curious to humanize him a little bit and see what's underneath the layers. And forgive me, I keep wanting to call him Eldin because of the video game about the rings written by George R.R. Martin. But at the end of the day, this guy is already immediately so interesting and compelling to me. We get like this revelation in like the opening of the bus as he like clearly has some vibes of his own, Josh, about where they have arrived.
Yeah, there's a great moment where he like, you know, he has had this horrible dream. He's terrified. He throws up on Jimmy from Yellowstone's shirt. We're eventually going to learn this guy's name, but for now I'm just going to call him Jimmy from Yellowstone.
Just lean into it.
We got to lean in until we have further information. And then Elgin's going to get looked at by Christy's fiance. And Christy's fiance is going to be like, do you know where you are? And Elgin says, do you? Which was so charged. It was such a great moment. I loved it so much. So I'm immediately in on the bus crew. I guess my question, Rich, is like, how long before they're all eviscerated? Is it just the next episode? Are they not going to abide by the stay inside rules?
I mean, I'm sure a couple of them will endure past the next episode, but I also feel like episode two is likely to be a real bloodbath, Josh.
Yeah.
We have just like stacked a lot of emotionally charged people who do not fully understand the context of what's happening here inside a diner with two like, semi-aggressive leaders of this community armed with guns and shooting into the air to like gain control of the crowd. I just rewind back to our preview pod and I think like the Strangers with Candy option definitely would have been better. Never end. Infinite pancakes. Like, this is rough.
This is not the way. I love Donna's like, all right, Kenny, well, Boyd picked a hell of a time to get out of town, and he may not be coming back, and you're really going to need to step up. And Kenny's like, all right, I got it. I'm pretty good to get. I've got my oh my God, my girlfriend who I wanted to be boyfriends with has her fiance here, and I'm heartbroken. I'm just going to start shooting at the sky. I'm already all upset. So I feel like Kenny's first day as deputy of Frumsville Maybe not going so well, Rich.
Kenny went 0-60. Yeah, I mean, as soon as Donna starts shooting tires out, I do have to say, I love Donna.
Donna
she is
shooting
so much
tires
fun,
out
man.
Was remarkably great. Yeah, one of my favorite things.
Her, like, taking command of the situation and, like, kind of dressing Kenny down of, like, all right, buddy, time to step up. You're the sheriff now, you know? Yeah. I really, like, loved it. But Kenny, like, yeah, 0-60 as he starts shooting into the air. Like, Kenny, these people all just badly panicked at the gunfire as they're, like, parked here on the side of the road next to the collapsing house. We'll get there. But it seemed like a real way to escalate the situation very quickly, Josh.
Yeah, I don't know what the better move was. What I did appreciate was maybe some of the newcomers to the show, not even like the newcomers to the town, would have benefited from hearing like Donna reset the stakes a little bit more. But having just power binged the show again, and it's all really fresh for me right now, when like we just kind of cut in on Donna talking to the bus driver and being like, yeah, and then there's monsters, and they got big teeth. And the bus driver's like, I don't know what you're talking about, lady. You're kind of freaking me out. I don't believe any of this.
I love the beat where she's like, if you all stay out here after dark, you're all going to die horribly. If you want me to explain it a little bit more later, we can once things settle down. But right now, get your asses in the diner. It's just like, my word, man.
Yeah.
Very like forceful in making your point. Clearly not as much time to go through like the standard operating procedure that we saw with the Matthews family at the beginning of season one, right?
All right. So I think of the bus characters that we are like getting to know, if not yet by name, then at least by vibe. I would love to sort of just like maybe make some early calls as to where these stories go for them, or at least like maybe like order the like call the order in which they're going to get like graphically murdered. Because like I feel like it's coming for most, if not all of them, probably not all of them ultimately, but we've got Elgin is on board. We've got Christie's fiance on board, Jimmy from Yellowstone, the bus driver, and the rain dancer. Rain dancer goes first, right? Rain dancer is the first off the board.
Probably in some pretty terrible way. I wouldn't be surprised if Sarah returns only to like kill the rain dancer for some horrible reason. I have to figure she's the first of that five, though I do think that five have like a measure of protection compared to all of the rest of the anonymous redshirted bus passengers.
Right? Let's take the gawkers off the menu, because like the gawkers, really, as they are wont to do, are going to go. And they'll go quick.
Very effectively this episode. I mean, they knew their roles. They got right to their jobs. So yeah, I think if we're talking about the big five, I would say maybe the bus driver goes before the rain dancer, if only because of her absolute incredulity at what Donna's explaining and her like ferocious, like the callback to emergency services, Josh, like let emergency services deal with it. We'll get to the next town and we'll inform emergency services. She's going to learn real quickly the error of her ways, that there are no emergency services coming for you, bus driver.
None at all. I hope that the bus driver makes it. I think she's great. I want to see her and Donna become like a powerful duo of friendship. I feel like that is a possibility here. I think inevitably the Jimmy from Yellowstone character, AJ Simmons, is the actor. I feel like he is not necessarily short for this show, but I do think ultimately, I don't know that this show is big enough for somebody who kind of has like his attitude plus Jade with Jade's attitude. Though he could serve as kind of a compelling mirror to Jade, as far as like Jade took a while to like, as to his name, he was sort of like this jaded perspective coming into the town. Now he's sort of like still has that sardonic personality as seen in like his interactions with Ethan in this episode while he's like figuring out more about his quest. But he is like on a quest and he like gets like, okay, I'm on a quest. Donna, there's a bus that just pulled up to the diner. You got to go get those people. So I feel like Jade getting like a mirror of somebody who's sort of like similar to him could be cool, but ultimately I feel like this is going to be short-lived for this guy in the long haul.
Interesting, because I was looking at him as very much the onion that I think we're going to like peel back. What really stood out to me is
We're going to peel him apart.
I guess, yeah.
Monster style.
Monsters might definitely peel him up like an onion in a salad. He was so quick to like jump to go help Jim, though, right? As soon as the house goes down, like I wouldn't be surprised to get some kind of like war veteran story out of this guy, and he's like cynical and kind of angry at the world because of his own traumatic experience that he's quietly carrying behind him that will elicit terrible sympathy for us, which I guess, according to your prediction, would be the perfect time to kill him off when we like learn to love him. So yeah, it tracks.
right now at this early stage, if you're telling me that the choice is between Jade or the Jimmy from Yellowstone character, I know who I'm sending to the 4-6s.
A million percent. If I get a vote, if we're kicking somebody out the door to the monsters, then it's Jimmy. It does not have any hope versus Jade.
I feel like Christie's fiance is a season long character at the very least. I feel like this sort of love triangle thing that we're about to get into has the potential to be the most eye rolly element of season two for me, but it also has the potential to be a really sad emotional story for not just for Kenny, who's clearly feeling very sad boy about it, but I think even for Christie could feel pretty conflicted about her original loyalty plus this new relationship that she embarked on with Kenny. So I guess I am just glad that she's there, because it does feel the Grand Rapids bus pulling up after we hear that she's from Grand Rapids. If Christie's fiance hadn't been there, I don't know, would that have been preferable to you than her actually being on the bus?
I'm with you. It took me far too long, I think, Josh, as a discerning TV viewer, to put together, this single woman who is also a medical professional is definitely the one who is Christie's fiance.
Right.
But there was the point where I started to ask myself, wait, is she not on the bus? I talked about it a little bit on the preview podcast, but synchronicity, this idea, popularized by Carl Jung, I think is so prevalent across the show. And the more that you dig into this idea that there's no such thing as coincidences, these events that may not be necessarily causally related have a greater import or impact, and there is a connection to that, and it's something that we as people acknowledge and address, and there's value to that psychologically in terms of learning ourselves and knowing ourselves. So to that extent, I think that it would have been a real missed opportunity if she wasn't there, right? I would have been big time disappointed, and I can see the world, Josh, just really get under the baseless speculation quickly, where Kenny is going to be left with some terrific Sophie's Choice regarding this woman of I can save her or I could leave her outside this talisman protected house with the monsters, and it's going to be rough for Kenny, given some of the moral dilemma that I think we saw him face here in episode one, right?
Yeah, he's usually been a pretty stalwart stand-up guy, but we've also seen this town can do a number on people, and it can really appeal to your worst instincts. So with a Kenny in that situation, I think on another show, I would feel Kenny would just save her. But on something From, I can totally envision the world where something really dark could happen here. And we could be in the season of Darth Kenny is not something that I would be shocked to see. I'd be heartbroken, but I could see it.
A million percent. I'm just projecting off of this, you gotta toughen up kid speech that Don is ultimately giving to him. And what does it mean to step into this role? Part of Boyd's role, it's the Wolverine job in the X-Men, Josh, I'm gonna get my hands dirty so you don't have to. And at some point, this responsibility weight will bear down on Kenny, I think, to the extent that he might get a little bit more cynical in his outlook. He's been through a harrowing couple of days. His dad did kind of just die.
Very recently.
He's dealing with some real hard stuff. Boyd leaving, everything that's happening here now with this Christie situation, so close, but yet so far away, right?
Elgin's really interesting to me.
So interesting.
We love these characters on this show that seem to have these supernatural connections to the place. And so we have clocked in the past that Ethan once had a seizure shortly after arriving here. We saw Sarah have one as well. I don't know who else off the top of my head we have seen in this mode, but we are seeing Elgin in this mode. And so instantly through this new character, we might have a new point of view into why certain people seem to dream about the place as they arrive. He's not unique to this, but he is the latest on that list of people who have had big From vibes and then wake up and find that they are in Fromsville itself.
Yeah, for sure. Something I talked about a lot in that preview was the notion of these childlike characters, including Jade and Victor with Sarah and Ethan to a degree. And you look back historically at epilepsy, at seizures, there was a time where this was espoused as the sacred disease throughout Greek and Roman mythology. There was this notion of it providing visions, right? You have all of these suggestions that people Julius Caesar, I believe, Hercules, even suffered from these kind of like seizures. And so I think we're playing with a lot of like classical mythology in some unconventional ways with Fromm, right? And as he like falls into this category with characters as prominent as Sarah and Ethan, that's like a real eyebrow raiser. Did you clock his shirt, Josh? Did you notice the shirt?
I was too busy focused on the shirt he threw up on.
Yeah, the vomit definitely was like a solid misdirect on the other shirt. So he's wearing this orange shirt. It almost looked like it's got a symbol that's kind of vaguely in the shape of the state of Texas. I'm sorry, Texans. That's probably like grossly incorrect. But in the center of this image is a giant crow, like a single big black crow that seems to have maybe something on its back. And it's very like, okay, connective tissue, synchronicity. Here it is. Like the pieces line up, John.
Yeah. We know the crows on the tree stump, but we also saw like a dead crow getting feasted upon in the tunnels in this episode too. So a murder of crows indeed. My eye is on Elgin. I think he's a really interesting character. I look forward to more. Looking at the establishment here in Frommsville. So Donna and Kenny, they're kind of in charge right now. Jim, who has like sort of assumed something of a leadership role, he is like literally pinned underneath a house. Rich, the house has fallen in. Jim was there. He's trying to clear all of the wreckage out because Tabitha was ostensibly trapped underneath the wreckage. Little does he know that she is like in like the wrong place. She's in the bad place in the tunnels and everything. Once again, is this two premieres in a row now for Fromm where Jim finds himself trapped in some sort of precarious makeshift location? And this time he doesn't even have a talisman. I'm really concerned for Jim heading into episode two.
Yeah, I'm more concerned for Tom the bartender.
Oh, yeah, Tom the bartender's toast. No
he's
way.
He's smoked. There is no chance he's getting out of
he
that.
He got
rubble.
The visibility spike in this episode. Like, oh, I don't like this for Tom.
I had a moment of like, oh, cool. We're going to make Tom the bartender. Oh, no, Tom. RIP, Tom.
Yeah.
You're going to get Frogered in, I think, right here.
For sure.
It's a little like arsed energy, right?
Yes.
I love, this is very specific, Josh, but the way that the house collapsed felt very authentic compared
to like, all right. Tell
yeah,
me
compared
more.
To like a poltergeist scenario of like the house imploding. Like it just, I've been near enough of these things practically in my real life of like a demolished building, a fire, the foundation gives out. I live in upstate New York. We don't talk about it on the podcast, but houses fall down up here sometimes. They're not in great repair. And so I really appreciated the like context of all of it. I love so much
points
actual...
for realism from points
for
real.
Realism. Yeah, for real. I loved the RV as like a set in the season one premiere of them being trapped there overnight and getting Boyd and Christy in there with Jim and Ethan. So I really like the way that this kind of mirrors and just environmentally, like I bought it, you know, it didn't feel like a TV house collapsed in. But I will question, Josh, we talked about the rules of the talismans. Donna's like, it's not going to work. It's got to be inside a house or a car. And like, would it not work? It's like mostly a house. It's kind of got a roof.
The other thing too is like, why not try?
Right.
What's the worst that I guess the worst that happens is like, if they can come in, can they just like pick up a talisman and snatch a talisman? So you've lost a talisman, or even if the house collapses further and then you lose the talisman that
if
way.
They get the talismans. Can they use them like idle nullifiers? I mean, that might be an issue.
Yeah, I think so. But you have to know who is using their talisman first. So it's still kind of a shot in the dark, but it's not the shot in the dark. I do think like they could have hung one up, especially if like we're not really in Colony House tonight. It seems like they poked a big hole in Colony House. So most of the Colony Housers, I think, are here at the diner with the Greyhound bus. So it feels like they could consolidate some talismans for the evening. They could have afforded one to poor Jim and Tom. And then whoever this other guy is in the shirt, he was on the bus as well.
The kid in the jacket, as Tom refers to
him. That dude's dead. Absolutely. Like he's like first to go. And then I think it's Tom. And then if they want to be really savage, the show will kill Jim as well in the second episode. That would be crazy.
That would be very crazy. Yeah, it seems like a real, like, a bad conservation of resources here. Mm-hmm. Just throw the guys one talisman, man. What's the big deal? The fact that, like, Julie doesn't push harder on it worked. What I really love most about this, like, dare I say it, Josh, but Julie is one of the characters that I think has been kind of least compelling for me.
Sure,
so
yeah,
far.
Yeah, yeah.
And this, like, really invests.
A lot of, I hate you, Mom. I hate you, Dad.
It's angsty teenager energy, right? Like, if I want that, I'll go watch Anakin Skywalker.
A thankless job for the young actors tasked with this kind of stuff, but it often is just like, it's a little hard to sit through.
For sure. But this immediately made wherever she's going to end up much more compelling, because you've now taken both her parents off the board. And like the relationship with Ethan early on in the RV, she's such like the older sister, giving him crap, teasing him, like kind of doesn't care. But like she ultimately is now defaulted to this role of protector, and she's super invested. The like emotionality. I mean, Jade notes it a couple times, like, oh, you're doing a daughter or father thing. Okay, I can respect it. I can respect it. It's like, I dig it. I dig it.
Yeah. Yeah. So she's concerned, rightfully so, I think. Here's what I really want from the collapsed house situation. I really want to see like some of the monsters like ease their way down in there. We know they go really slow. So I would love like the sort of like slow creeping horror would just be like sort of a terrifying thing to endure. But what I would really love to see happen is like, what happens if they're still down there and the sun starts coming up? Because like, I don't think that we've really seen like the process of retreating before from the monsters, right? Nothing that comes to mind for me.
Not at all, no. And I thought it was really notable, like shifting a little bit to we see Tabitha and Victor come out of that cave in the woods. Right. And there was like the big moment of like, oh, is this really where they sleep? Are all of them in there? Are they all like coming in their slow shuffle exodus out of there at night? So yeah. I'm with you. I think it would be really cool for us to like, you know, move a little bit away from the Jaws techniques. Like I want to see a little bit more of these monsters' functionality. Like
will
what's
they just
going
like
on
puff
here?
Into like a cloud of fog? Like they just like immediately evaporate when the daytime comes? Is this like sort of like, do they burn like vampires? What would happen? Like, because if like they like work their way down into the house, they lose track of time, and then they're like, oh, you know what, I just exploded. I would like to see what happens to one of these monsters in the daylight.
Yeah, 1,000,000%. I just want to see more of the monsters. Like, we'll talk about them, but I kind of loved what we got of this episode and like some clarity on the rules that we're dealing with in this town, specifically for the talismans, for the monsters. Like, I want more, 1,000,000%. Yes.
So let us go into the tunnels, Rich. We are spending some time with Victor and Tabitha in the tunnels. It does appear to be that Victor has just been hanging out here waiting for Tabitha. The voice told him, wait for Tabitha. She's coming. Here she is. She shows up. The voice has also told Victor, there's no going back. We have to go through. You have to be brave. We both have to be brave. And as they're going to work their way through the tunnels, we're going to see some weird, scary, spooky, spooky shit. We see rats eating some dead crows. We see like this, what is it? Is this like a wedding dress? Is it a nightgown?
I thought it was a nightgown, though. I guess wedding dress could work in that like weird suitcase with all the kind of like travel stickers on it. Again, like just vibes to me. It harkened back to like the 50s in the same way a lot of the wardrobe does for the monsters, right?
Yeah, there's this one big room that has like this old timey wheelchair. There's a bird cage. There's some wheelbarrow. There's like all of these chests with books. There is a TV set. So that starts to like sort of like date a couple of these appliances, it feels like. Then there's also like this deadish body with it looked like a diner uniform on. So like, Victor's having big reactions to a lot of these people and things that he is seeing. He sees the ventriloquist dummy that we're going to see Jade also sees in one of his visions in this episode. Is Victor like being confronted with like the like the remnants of the original group of people he was with back in the day? Is that something that might be happening? Because he's like really, really freaked out by all of this.
It sure feels like that. Like, as we saw these monsters wearing human faces in season one, there was no point where anybody actively seems to be like, save maybe the grandma situation in episode one. Like, this is somebody I know. I recognize this person, right? And it feels, especially as we come to like the end of that whole cavern sequence, like Victor recognizes some of these people and he recognizes some of these things. He may just be shocked that he found John Locke's wheelchair.
It's possible. It's possible that he's like, oh, I solved it. I solved the thing. The scariest thing is this like stone Jenga tower thing that then like a ball comes rolling in, like it's bowling, and it knocks the thing over. And there's like this tiny little prison cell with this spooky, like soggy looking, like a well lady creature on the other side of it, like straight out of The Ring.
I thought that for a second Tabitha found Gollum down there. I was like, oh my God, huge Gollum vibes. And then even to like some of these other beats, right? The whole thing with like the doll, the marionette puppet, dolls are like often used. They have this symbol, like we talk about symbols being important. And so they're used in storytelling as symbolism of like, they exist across all cultures. It's again, like touching in on this Jungian collective unconscious. All of us, no matter where we are in the world in our little isolated from Vils, are experiencing a lot of the same ideas as we like conceptualize the world around her. And the dolls often get used to explore ideas about like divinity, about life and death, about the creation of life. Not to mention that, like, yes, they are creepy. It is just creepy,
so creepy
and unsettling and like a great tactic. And then this whole pile of stones, like the stone stacking thing has become like super popular in like state parks in the last like 20 years, which like maybe don't stack all the stones. It's really bad for erosion, my friends. But
this is like, it's like crop circle adjacent.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And like, it's touching on stone cairns. This is like a very traditional way to like bury the dead and to create like even trail markers that are like used in like the contemporary kind of way. But this cairn, like, it's just an evocative image that like sets you up, and the baseball rolling in is creepy, but it does like vibe with this memorial for the dead as we're looking at all these like desiccated people like napping in the corner. Right,
and they are napping.
Yeah,
then they get up, and they're all like these like soggy faced monstrous things. So, like, are those the monsters? Is this like their true form? Is this some sort of like separate deal? Where, I mean, we know that the word from Victor is this is where they sleep. So, is this them in like their sleeping form? And as night falls, do they get like a little more, you know, alive? I suppose, for lack of a better word.
It's so interesting you touch on this question, because it didn't even occur to me like in real time watching it that they might be anything but the monsters.
Yeah.
Like, they're so nefariously presented. But then when we meet like Old Man River up at the top of the chimney there, this guy seems like he's been chained to that wall for about 1,000 years, Josh, right? And like, there's part of me now that's asking myself like, oh my God, are these a bunch of survivors that just hold up in this cave and like, you don't die unless the monsters kill you? You in Fromville, and they have successfully evaded the monsters for too long. Like, it's kind of like staying in the bathtub for too long, you know, and you get
you just get like way too soggy.
They
got like pruned. I don't know. There's like a heavy pruning that happened to these creatures.
I mean, notable, the episode opens with Bob Dylan's A Hard Rain Coming, which is a song about like desperate people, like trapped in a desperate situation. There was like a lot of conjecture at the time that it was about like, specifically the Cuban Missile Crisis and the fear of like radioactive hard rain. But really, it's about human suffering and about how humanity's brains have been like conditioned to expect suffering, which like maps so well onto this story that we're telling. But they could have just been out in the hard rain too long.
Yeah, that could have been it. They just got soggy as a result. So we see the dummy in the tunnels, and I think that's a good segue into Jade and his quest. And so like a lot of Jade's story in this episode, once like the storm is happening and the, you know, the radio gear is like getting destroyed and they have bigger fish to fry than calling the radio tower anymore, it seems like maybe it was a bad idea. Jade starts to get refocused on smoking his last J while he's got it, and B, like getting back into sort of this hunt for the symbol. So he's been like plagued by visions of this symbol for most of the show, if not all of his time on the show so far. And he last season started getting a little bit into like, Victor has reproduced this image. Like, I've seen this amongst Victor's stuff before. So like, Victor's got to be the key to this. And so Jade and Ethan, little boy Ethan, end up teaming up a little bit to figure out what's going on with the symbol. And Jade is going to like swear like a sailor in front of poor Ethan. I think he says, get used to it. All right. Like, this is what I do. And he is going to find this book of Victor's that has these two pages stuck together. And at first I was like, don't explore that further.
I don't like that.
Yeah. Mercifully, it is like stuck together by a Polaroid. And then I was like, wait, let's really not go there. But it turns out the Polaroid is of a man who has this journal, and Victor as a boy is in the background with his little lunch pail. And Ethan's like, all right, Jade, well, very clearly you're on a quest, like all the quests that I've read about as a small boy and all these things. But the thing that you got to figure out is, are you looking for a good symbol or a bad symbol? Like, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Symbols are important, especially on a quest, he says, but you have to figure out if they're good symbols or bad symbols. Sometimes bad symbols will make you do bad things. Simple question, Rich, is it a good symbol or a bad symbol?
It kind of looks like a bad symbol.
Looks like
Josh.
A bad symbol to
it
me.
It seems like a menacing looking symbol. Very aggressive, sharp edges.
Yes. So I feel like the symbol is probably bad. And if Ethan is calling this out, at the very least, it's got to be like a dangerous thing to handle and some sort of like, is Jade, am I like concerned about the wrong guy? Is it like Jade is the one who's sort of like on the dark path this season?
I would hate that, but it would be very innovative. I got to say, I'm in a show with like Harold Perrineau and Ian Bailey that like I love so much from other stuff. Like, it speaks to the writing that Jade is like pretty quickly become my favorite character.
He's
like,
the best.
He just is so explosive. The performance from David Alpay is so like kind of manic, but like natural. Him like sitting there like, this is not a normal cigarette kid, while he's like cursing up a storm, having this very adult conversation with Ethan. Like, this is my favorite of the unlikely pairings this episode. And the two of them like getting swept up into this quest, like, I think to a degree, I talked about it a lot on the preview, Jade has this really juvenile perspective on the world, on like his outlook. He talks about building this company out of nothing, out of sheer imagination. And I think there's a certain amount of like of youthfulness that you need to hold on to stay creative and innovative and all of that. So these two like syncing up and Jade like recognizing some of the wisdom from the mouths of babes, like what the F's a Cromer-knuckle doesn't matter.
Uh-huh.
The message comes through that like, you, it doesn't matter about the Cromer-knuckle, Jade, you're on a quest.
Yeah. I kind of feel like the Cromer-knuckle might matter. That's all
it's
that
going
I
to
say.
Matter
what,
yes.
Is a Cromer-knuckle, Rich? Do we know what a Cromer-knuckle is?
I think this is like amongst the children's books that Ethan had when the RV crashes. One of these stories is about the Cromer-knuckle, right? And we get in those early season one episodes when the family is finally kind of reunited and Jim gets out of the RV. Ethan's all healed up. They all sit together to like read the Cromer-knuckle. Like, notably, again, I talked about it on the preview podcast, but Victor's use of this term, the faraway tree. The faraway tree is a real series of children's books.
Yeah.
Written from like 39 to early 50s, that the more you think about it, like, they're the kind of children's books that Victor would have grown up
totally
reading,
100%.
Because he was a little kid. And there's a little bit of like, if you dig into what that story's about, a mystical wood and a magical tree, and like the villages in the tree keep changing. So I think to the notion of like the Cromer-knuckle becoming important, 100%. Yeah, I'm like all over the place, but again,
I think we're gonna have
like,
to book club the faraway tree at some point.
I would love to book club it. I'm sure.
Gotta book club it. Yeah. The last storyline of the episode that we have not talked about yet is like, not a lot happens in terms of like the amount of this storyline, and yet in many ways, I feel like the most happens in this storyline, where Boyd is still trapped in the wall, and I apologize for not saying the wall. He is trapped in the wall, and he's like gonna try and like spider climb his way out, and he can't do it. And then he hears this old decrepit voice from up above. Oh, someone's down there. You must come up. You must see me. And Boyd says, I can't. I tried to spider climb this thing, and I should be able to do it. I just got bit by a radioactive spider, and I'm not able to climb it. And so the voice says, oh, well, I may have something to help you out. And a rope gets cast down to help Boyd climb. And climb he shall. And the rest of the Boyd scenes of the episode are like the opposite of the Lost finale. He is climbing up the rope, not down. and he is, I mean, like, really, like, this is very opposite of the hatch itself. Mm-hmm. He is, like, climbing out of a hatch to meet a strange person. And he is going to, like, see an image of his son, of Ellis, telling him, like, oh, it's time for the boat. But obviously that's not real. He eventually gets out of the chimney, and what he finds is who I have called the Count of Frumy Cristo, and he is chained to the wall, and he is old and gaunt and desperate to die. He tells Boyd, oh, is that a gun? Great! Just shoot me already. And it's like, no, you need to stay alive long enough to answer some questions, sir. And also, here's the first question I have, and I'll ask Rich because I can't ask you, Count of Monte Cristo, because you're not a real person. What? How were you able to kick a rope down?
Gotta wonder. Very notably, the room is like lit with torchlight in the corner, which is like, who lit that? What's going on here? How, you're very chained to that wall. This is not like a casual wall chaining that we
you like
here,
look like
you know?
You've been chained to that wall for decades. Decades,
my man,
sir,
does look like he could use a sandwich. Maybe even a dead crow would go a long way. So maybe he just slipped his wrist out of the manacles and like ran over, jumped back in.
Could be.
But like, I do think there's some weird mysticism here. I appreciate that you say that he cast the rope down. Rope trick, second level spell. Check it out.
It's maybe it was that. Maybe it's a literal spell that he cast. He does say like, he'll be back any minute. Kill me now. So he's talking about like, he's coming. He's coming. Who has tied this man up? How did this man get a rope down to Boyd? What's going on here? I should have known that that Boyd being trapped in some sort of hatch-like apparatus, Rich, was going to collide us with a new character. And yet, I just didn't quite see it coming this way, at least. Old Man Desmond is here in the house.
Old Man Desmond. I thought he was the knight from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, you chose poorly.
The Last Crusade, how dare I? Yeah. But I really love the vibe. So again, like, I was kind of joking about the golem in the cage in the caves, but like, why is there a cage in the caves with the dead sleeping people? It seems like whatever they had in there is caged up, and where it really spoke to me of Gollum, I'm talking about like the older like Ralph Bakshi illustrations of Gollum, and then even like some of the Andy Serkis transformation shots that we get in Return of the King. There is this technique whereby they like almost push down the like cheekbones and like widen them, and as we look at this guy on the wall, his cheeks, I mean, no judgment for his physical appearance, but they look like tea saucers, Josh.
Yeah.
They're huge. It looks like his whole face has been kind of like spread out and like extending, and it really is that same vibe of like butter scraped across too much bread, right? I got this huge vibe of like, this guy has been like chained to this wall waiting to die for a very long time, and he's asking about the gun, not because he can't see well, which he probably can't, but because like, this is a very modern weapon and he has not maybe seen a gun since the Civil War or whatever, right? Also, like, notably, just tracking with my like architectural observations from here, it's very much like a basement, right? They're in this like stone room, and the chimney is kind of like a well where there's this huge apparatus above it with a winding spool of rope. That's where the rope is coming down from. It's lit by firelight in torches, in scones, not the ones you eat, in the walls, and roof above them is wooden, which makes me feel like they're underneath a house, like one of the houses. Which house is it? Is it the house with a hole in the floor? Maybe that feels like poignant, but like, yeah, I don't know. Vibes. These are my vibes, Josh.
Big vibes. I'll tell you what my biggest fear is. My biggest fear, not like my biggest fear overall, because I don't want to expose myself to that kind of vulnerability.
Say, didn't we attack your biggest fear overall in this episode with eye stuff? I mean, we were pretty
good.
Close.
We're good on the eye stuff. I did like twitch a little bit when like the glass was stuck in the eye. I was like, okay. She's like, I think something's stuck in here. Do I look? You look fine. You look fine. Everything's okay.
Like,
Everything's fine. You're all right. My biggest concern as it pertains to Boyd in this situation is that this creature, and I'm calling him a creature, is chained to the wall for a reason. And Boyd, with like all of his infinite humanity wanting to do the right thing, is going to release him. And that could be very bad for everybody, but especially immediately, imminently for Boyd. I don't think this show is necessarily above killing Harold Perrineau, period, but even potentially this early. So I'm worried. I'm always on edge with this show. After they did what they did to Father Khatri, I feel like everybody's fair game. And I just don't trust this guy. I feel like we are inclined not to. Rich, this show centers a bunch of like human-looking creatures that then like their mouths twist and contort to contain infinite teeth with
which
they
look
to
like
eat
us
you.
Now. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's really yeah. tricky. It's very confusing when the enemy is like wearing human faces
yes.
to be able to like sort through what's what here. I would not put it past the show to kill off Boyd either. I do think like the death of Father Khatri was a real gut punch and like, look, nobody's safe. That being said, I thought you were going to articulate a much more meta fear, which is like they're going to keep Boyd locked in this house with this creature for episodes upon episodes.
Yeah.
And, like, we're not going to drive his storyline forward. Part of what I loved about season one is like how quickly it moves. The pace like really kind of goes at a skip. A lot of stuff goes down pretty quickly in those few days. So I'm really hopeful that Boyd is not like in this little bit of a bottle, like of being trapped in the basement with the creature and whatever else is coming. Right?
Yeah, unless the creature is like supremely interesting. Like, is this going to have Benjamin Linus upside, right? Mm-hmm. Like, is whoever this person is, like, my name is Henry Gale. I'm from Minnesota. I saw the tree. You know, like, is it going to be a really compelling character that we're going to get to know? Then I would be down with Boyd being here for a minute, depending on, like, that character work. But I don't know that this is that show. I think, to your point, From tends to be fairly propulsive. Although I think that the first two episodes of season one, I'm getting sort of like a similar structural vibe here. Mm-hmm. I guess we have to see how episode two pertains. But for me, like a lot of this first episode of season two is real setup stuff. Like
it's an exciting incident. Yeah.
Reestablishing where we were in season one and sort of establishing where we have to go now.
Yep, it feels like big inciting incident energy, like resetting with our cast a little bit. To your point of like episodes one and two of season one, you know, the second episode is a real like, let's get to know everybody, right? Yeah. Let's really like get a sense of the town, the geography, the people, the players, their motivations. So I wouldn't be disappointed to follow that track. I just, you know, I hope whatever we're doing with Boyd, we don't compartmentalize him too much from the rest of the cast. I think part of the like great energy about this show, what I've enjoyed about it is the ensemble, and so much of Boyd vibing off of other people through season one was like really where I was having the most satisfaction, if not always the most fun. Those are like the Jade scenes, right?
Yeah.
But I loved like the Boyd and Father Khatri stuff. I love the relationship between Boyd and Donna. I want him like back with those people sooner than later.
Yeah. All right. So let's wrap up with some odds and ends and maybe look at the theory wall, Rich. Is there anything that we are drawing on the theory wall for this episode? Anything that has like our wheels are spinning based on the new information we've got? I think very importantly, like the dreaming is a big deal.
Mm-hmm. So I would say theory wall. I do want to put up, I think that Kenny in some way is going to be implicated in the death of fiance Nurse. I don't know if that's like a viable theory.
Yeah.
I do definitely have a theory about like the like old man there, the Count of Monte Frumsville.
Yeah.
I feel like he has been there since like the Civil War, just aging on this wall.
Oh my gosh.
And, like,
yeah.
I don't know. That feels like a thing. I don't know why. Like the Hulk, the costuming, the undershirt, it's clear he has not bathed anytime recently. The whole like begging for death. I don't think he's going to be the malicious entity that you speculate about, but more so like, I think he's been like trapped in time, you know. I think we're playing with time travel in unconventional ways here, in the idea of like life and death and extended life and unnatural life and what that means and how that can change you, right?
I need to get a better look at this guy with more scenes, because one of the crazier thoughts that I felt like I had was, is that time traveling Victor? Like,
oh my God.
For me, like, I just had like there was like something about like the gaunt quality about Victor and like the child trapped in this adult body. And like, I could imagine some Victor energy from this older man, but I don't have clarity on the actor who plays this guy. I don't know if that's just like Scott McCord in gaunt makeup. By the time we get to our episode 2 recap, I'm sure there's gonna be like articles and explainers and stuff, and we'll have a cast list. But like, my wildest part of my like overexcited theory brain was like, time traveling Victor, that's old man Victor.
I could totally track. I mean, Scott McCord does have these very like hawkish features, right? Yeah. He's really sharp and gaunt and like tall and lean in that way. I couldn't get a sense of like his scale hanging off the wall like that, but I could see it now that you mention it. I do think that there's like, God, some kind of time travel component element happening here. I just think it's a little bit like unconventional in terms of the ways it gets used in stories. I don't think this is about us going back in the past necessarily, but there's weird time shenanigans happening here.
Yeah. You know? Other theory I have is that the rain dancer woman is specifically on the show so that she can be like turned into some kind of horrible monster creature. I just feel like that whole energy of like the rain, go away. Like, it just feels like that character, that actress was like placed on this show specifically to give us the heebie-jeebies. So I think like knowing that these monsters have some measure of shape-shifty ability, I feel like she is on a collision course with being some sort of shape-shifty creature monster.
I can totally track that. I dig it. I think that, I don't know, just to go back to like the room with the Count of Monte Frumsville, I do think that there's like a very good likelihood that that house is like underneath Colony House or something like that. It's going to be under somewhere really important, whether that is like the diner or Colony House. Those seem like the two most important like indoor locations that we've tracked, right?
Could it be we saw like the lighthouse on the hill in the season one finale? Could they be in the lighthouse?
Ooh, yeah. I think you've just like totally swayed me. I'm in. I'm all in on that theory. Yes.
I want to know more about the lighthouse. All right. Anything else that you've got about the From premiere? I think it's a really fun setup here.
No, I really liked it. I did think it was great setup. You know, I love Tabitha and Victor. That was like another unlikely pairing. I think getting to like see Tabitha in this like mothering role with Victor was really endearing to me.
With this guy who like maybe endangered her child one, some episodes earlier.
Just like back and forth of both of them building her up, right? Him being like, I know you're afraid, you just have to be quiet. I love that. That was really fun. I love like Donna just like takes no BS, just like taking command of the situation, totally here for it. I thought it had great energy and it really was like good vibes to set us up. A lot of like little details that I'm tracking on as we go into episode 2.
All right, we're finding our footing here as season 2 continues next week. These shows are dropping on Sundays, as will the podcast. I think our episode 2 recap will come a little bit later on Sunday next week, April 30th, when we get into episode 2, The Kindness of Strangers, which you can always depend upon, as I am to understand, Rich. It is going to be all of these episodes, I think, actually, for season 2 are directed by Jack Bender. So Jack Bender getting his stamp on everything. That's really neat. So The Kindness of Strangers is coming next. Make sure you do not miss an episode of the From podcast here on Post Show Recaps. PostShowRecaps.com/from is the RSS link when you search by URL. Leave a rating, leave a review. If you've got some time, we want to bring everybody into Fromsville alongside us. If you want the commercial-free versions of this podcast, go to patreon.com/postshowrecaps. Sign up at any level to be a patron of the pod. You will get commercial-free versions of the From podcast. If you've got feedback, you can email me, josh@postshowrecaps.com. I'm also at Round Howard, wherever you can find me. Rich is at DM Philly, wherever you can find him, including Twitter, and most importantly, Twitch. How is the Twitching going at this moment in time, Rich?
The Twitch has been good. We're mostly just rock and drag and fly. It's D&D in space with a bunch of your friends and mine, Josh. But it's been a very fun D&D in space campaign. Some more stuff coming over there soon. I think I'm going to be streaming some Star Wars video games in the upcoming future. So that's kind of exciting and a very good time.
We love to hear it. All right, folks, we are getting back into From next time around, The Kindness of Strangers, season 2, episode 2. Until next time, everybody, take care. Goodbye.